So what's in a name? Let's actually take a look at the term contemporary worship itself and its history just a little bit and see what looking at the term can tell us. So I want you to imagine something new, different, and distinctive in worship. So imagine an urban church with a desire to offer a second service of a totally different style. And it wants to plan it as a creative, innovative service, but not for its sanctuary. The goal, according to the announcement, is a service planned with the needs of today's young adults in mind. There's that generational thinking. And perhaps the church's eye is to the thousands of students at the nearby university. And so the advertisement begins. Come to the new contemporary service, they say, for something new, something different, something distinctive. Okay? And the new contemporary worship service will begin on April the 5th. Okay? So, something new, different, distinctive in worship, these young adults in mind. What year?
1970.
But it actually was this church. Holland Park United Methodist Church, right next to the campus of Southern Methodist University. And one of the main instigators of this new contemporary service was this man, James White. And another professor there, Arden Gray, at Perkins School of Theology. This is one of the rises of the term contemporary worship. Not just the 1990s, but this unmooring and this experimentation in the late 60s into the 70s. So what I want to do is give a preliminary overview of the term contemporary worship. My method would be to emphasize publication history, especially in books, with some coordination from early practitioners. And I'm going to use especially the Google ngram function. And if you have never discovered the ngram function in Google, you have not yet lived. Okay? Because you can go in starting in the year 1800 and designate the time periods and either the word or the phrase, and it will give you the frequency of publication and graph it out. So you have not yet lived if you have not discovered ngrams, okay? So we're going to take a look at the publication history of the term contemporary worship. Okay? So the broad currents, the current use of the term, as we're using it now, is actually the third of three eras in the 20th century. So there are three upswings in the use of the term contemporary worship. The current use is the most technically specific. And that's how we'll see the first instance of the term in the 1920s actually was not a technically specific term. Starts to get kind of be a technical term to have a contemporary service, contemporary worship, like this advertisement we saw from Highland Park, kind of semi-technical in the late 60s into the 70s. And then from 1994 forward, it's a technical term. The current era is the longest lasting. And something I acknowledged earlier, there are churches that have had contemporary services or contemporary worship, but have never used the term itself. And this history of the term, who uses it, who doesn't use it, when has it been used, when has it not been used, actually reinforces for me the complexity of a larger liturgical phenomenon that we've been talking about. The term contemporary worship tends to be mainly a mainline or a mainline evangelical sort of term. Just look at marquees. You go down the street, contemporary service, 9 o'clock, traditional service at 11. It helps us up a binary. And I'll explain some of the research that's been going on in the use of the term. So here are the three historic periods itself. And this is what you get when you use the Google ngram function. Okay, so you can see what I've done, and this is just a screenshot from Google. I've typed in the term contemporary worship. I've set the time parameters between 1910 and 2008, which unfortunately is the latest year that the ngram function goes through yet. You can set, you can tell what language you want to use, so you can, I've set it here for all of English. You can set it for American English or British English, and it will divide up publications that way. And then a smoothing of three, that will just, this is tends to be a good number to give you some level of distinction. I think if you go to 10, it would really smooth things out. But anyway, you can play around with it. But long story short, so here are the three periods of usage. This uptick in the late 1910s through the 20s, through the 30s, and then the falling off. I asked an ethnomusicological friend of mine, I said, why do you think that was? And he says, probably, perhaps, the rise of jazz and the attachment of the term contemporary music to jazz in this period. It's just a guess. Here's the other uptick, mid-1960s through the 70s, mid-70s, and then a falling off. And this example that I've shown you from Highland Park United Methodist Church is an example of that. It's a period of experimentation. If any of you ever had the Professor Don Husted or know of him, his book, Jubilate, he talks about this period of experimentation. That book comes out about 1981, 1982 or so. And I met Don Husted once, so I've got his voice going through my head. And he essentially says, good riddance. I'm glad it's over. Okay. He wasn't a big fan of the experimentation. And then here's the last major uptick, and then this is what most of us think of when we think of contemporary worship. So this actually has its starting in 1990. As I'll show you in just a second, well, that may mean that it's used in the body of text from the 1990s forward, but the first book that I can find with the term contemporary worship in the title is 1994. Abington Press, their summer 1994 catalog. When you're a history geek, I mean, one of the things you do is like go to publishers and say, pull me out all of your catalogs and let me go through them systematically, see what you've been offering. So I've done that for Baker's, Ondervan, and Abington so far.
Do you remember which book that was?
Mm-hmm. Community of Joy by Timothy Wright. Oh. Interesting. So it's a Lutheran associate pastor talking about the worship at his pragmatic Lutheran church in a suburb of Phoenix, Arizona. The Lutheran publishers don't really want to touch it, and so it comes over to the United Methodist Publishing House. And Abington Press, Cokesbury, which is the publisher of my book, they have published more books with the term contemporary worship in the title than any other publisher. So I think there's a distinctive role for Abington in terms of putting this on the mainline map, because it's not just Methodists who buy Abington books. Okay. Oh, okay.
Lester?
Yes?
Did you ever read Terry Fulham's book?
No, I don't think I have.
Okay. He was a Episcopal priest, used to teach at Barrington College in Rhode Island, and had this amazing movement in Connecticut that brought this church of 100 people to probably multiple thousands.
Wow.
And that was in mid-70s, and he used the term contemporary worship quite a bit.
Oh, okay.
And even in, you know, mid-70s. That,
what was his last name?
Fulham. F-U-L-L-O-M.
Will you give me that citation later? Yes. I would like to look at it. Here's a comparison to the term contemporary itself. The first period of use in the 1920s through the 30s. The other thing about the Google Ngram thing is once it gives you the graph, it also gives you bibliographic hyperlinks at the bottom of the page, so you can just start clicking on them and see how it's been used. I shouldn't even get paid to be a researcher anymore. Google Ngram makes it too easy. So I went through the hyperlinks at the bottom of the page, and what you get is that contemporary just means other particular people at a particular time and place. So you get interesting references to like the ancient Hittites and their contemporary worship, the ancient Israelites and their contemporary worship, okay? So it's a non-technical use. The second period, the late 60s through the 70s, and like I said, it's synonymous with the period of liturgical experimentation, okay? James White, his book, New Forms of Worship, is trying to document this. And this was my professor at Notre Dame, so I knew Jim White really, really well. And I trust his judgment. He says, this experimentation began in 1965. Jim White didn't guess. And I always called him the black hole of knowledge. There was no fact that had ever passed in front of him that didn't decide it. So when he says this experimentation began in 1965, you can bank that day. Okay. Notice, it was just turned majority age, legal adult age, in 64, 65. All the very first baby boomers. Born right after World War II. I think the coinciding of those two dates is not unusual. Okay? Okay. Let me see what I got here.
Oh, it's all my screen.
Oh, yeah. So this is me tracking for that limited time period, contemporary worship, and then corollary terms, creative worship, experimental worship, and innovative worship. You can see some bumpage up in these terms, but it's really contemporary worship, okay? Here's a nice sort of thing. This is a typical sort of piece from the period. 1960s era contemporary worship. This is the 1971 Interpreter magazine, which is a United Methodist magazine. Answering the question, what do you mean by contemporary worship? Characteristics identified. Innovative is the most central. Others, and then the exclamation points I did not add. They're in the original. So variety, continuity, now sound, participation, relationship, action, celebration. Okay? Over the top, but this is 1971, so think all colors, okay? You can just get a sense, if not anything else, but through the exclamation point, we're discovering something that's new. And it's the whole, you'll notice, I didn't mention it, the last slide of the previous presentation, contemporary worship, is it a gift or does it overcome a gap? I hate to oversimplify the entire history, but those are the two main motivations that I see. There are folks who say this new form of worship is a gift from God. There are other folks who say this new form of worship is something we need to do to overcome a gap between the church and people. This is gap thinking. All of this new stuff, innovation, authenticity, creativity, this is a now sound. This is what we need to do to be able to connect with folks, okay? So, and I'll come back to this. What was contemporary? When I actually get into the literature, this is how you do it, this is why you ought to do it, here's an example of doing it. What did they mean by contemporary in the 1960s? It's interesting, by and large, the first thing they don't point to is music. The first thing they do point to is English. The English is the switchover from archaic to updated English is the most striking aspect of making connection and a novelty. And in fact, so much so, I've got a whole presentation in our time together just looking at the English. But what does contemporary mean, updated English? But it also means being relevant. So like what we just did, everybody in the late 1960s involved in contemporary worship would applaud. Here's an example of something like Jim White would do. This is an actual service that he did in the chapel of Perkins School of Theology. So they would do their worship service, but they had set up multiple slide projectors and screens. And they were showing in perpetual loops images of urban life in Dallas while they're doing worship in the middle of that. Or they would get a perpetual sound loop of sound from urban life in Dallas, and that would provide the backdrop. So we don't want to do worship that's disconnected with all the concerns of the day. And I mean, just remember how much social turmoil there was in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Being up to date on that and speaking to that was what contemporary was. And then finally, they'll say, oh, and it also means updated music. Doing music in some new musical form. Okay. So I gave you that example. Here's another example. And again, the current state of my research, oftentimes my best examples are mainline or even United Methodist. This is a church, and I just love it because of the name of the service. The Church of Tech. And that's just the desire to be up to date. I mean, where in the world would they have gotten that term? Yeah. And discotheques, who do discotheques attract?
Not
millennials. Not millennials. But those of us who were youth at the time, like, oh, we've gone to discotheque, so a churchotheque, I'm there. Okay? And this was at Mount Vernon Place Methodist Church, which I actually, the latest meeting of the North American Academy of Liturgy was at the hotel right across the street. And so we actually went over there for an evening service. So I'm sitting in this church going, something about this church I remember. What is it? And then I went and checked my notes, and it's like, oh, wow. I've been to this church before through their article. So this is a picture of how to do it.
Wow.
So notice the keyboard.
Guitar.
It's hard to tell. There's the guitar. I mean, think. When did I say this was? 1967. Think of how radical that would have been in 1967. And if you can't tell, but if you look at the picture in the original magazine closely, it's very clear they're probably in a fellowship hall. They're not in the main sanctuary. But the other thing that gives them, so part of it makes it safer to have it in an alternative space rather than the main sanctuary. It often gives you flexibility in terms of seating, too. So you're not having to deal with pews. Particularly in the 60s and 70s, there's not a uniform form to contemporary worship. And there are multiple headwaters, multiple strands. They're constantly overlapping, merging, separating. Okay. The visual image I want to get in your mind, particularly among mainline worship, is mainline worship up to this time kind of being safely moored at the dock. Mm-hmm. And you might rearrange the deck chairs a little bit, but that ship is still safely moored at the dock. When you start seeing people who need people, you have released the lines. Okay. And that the whole propriety of experimentation and adaptability and trying to connect with people, those root elements are major ingredients of many strands of contemporary worship. Another example, this is Episcopal, actually, University of Michigan. And I love, the title of this book. I like the title of this book because it reinforces how not new the technological aspect sometimes is. So multimedia worship. This is the campus ministry at the University of Michigan. Here's the cover of the book. Notice the adaptation to the space. No pews, no seats. Where? And I see that in a lot of the pictorial representations of contemporary worship from the 60s and 70s. Because it gives you massive adaptability of space in terms of you just need some place to sit down in order to be able to worship. And it reinforced the informality of the time. And I think it tended to subtly, psychologically build a sense of community, connectedness among people that individual seats and pews tend not to. And then you can see what they've done here. So instead of all glory be to thee, they've put in a mime troupe doing the trial of the Cantonville Nine, who were war protesters, the Vietnam War protesters. There's a concern with relevance there. So they're gonna without words, they're gonna reenact this war protest as the evidence of being connected. I mean, to the current events. Okay. Like I pointed out earlier, this whole concern with contemporary language and concerns. Here are some books. Some of these titles I just love. Treat Me Cool, Lord, Prayers, Devotions, Litanies, as prepared by some of God's best tempered angels with busted halos. Oh, bad temper, yeah. And then notice the denominations are actually venturing into this too. Methodist, and then there's a whole series of Lutheran resources coming out, oftentimes geared for youth. Okay. I'll deal more with this language issue in its own separate section, but let me just point out a couple of things. New Bible translations of the time, all the new denominational worship texts tend not to revert to archaic language, but tend to update the language. I once heard Jim White tell me, I told the whole class this, the Methodists put out a new Book of Worship, 1964, I think it was, creatively entitled The Book of Worship. And he said it was obsolete as soon as it came out. And why was it obsolete? Because it was nothing but archaic King James English. Obsolete as soon as it came out. And then parallel to changing the extemporaneous prayer. And I think this is one of the untold stories of the current time that future worship historians will be fascinated by. How, in the span of less than a generation, the type language we expect in worship has totally shifted. I mean, if you think about it, from the start of the Reformation until the mid-1960s, the whole expectation, whether you're praying extemporaneously or using liturgical text, was archaic English, which at the beginning was not archaic English. From mid-60s to mid-80s, that entire thing shifts. And we just completely overlook it because we're so used to it and we like it, but future worship historians will be fascinated by that. That's a massive shift in 20 years. So where did the second era go? Jim White, prolific author, essentially said the better parts of it were absorbed, and people also got bored or tired of trying to create and innovate all the time. Okay. And then here's the section from the Don Husted. Just glad it's over. I want to suggest that some parts of this early era of contemporary worship are not over. The propriety of contemporary language and concerns and music have now become widely accepted. So these innovations got enough of those things in the headwaters at the time that we know we just accept them as a matter of fact now, particularly the language and even the music issue perhaps, or the relevancy issue. Okay. Period of the 70s and 80s, the incubation, we'll deal more with that history. You can see the drop-off in this frequency of publication. And the nice thing about ngram is you can ask for it to distinguish between uncapitalized and capitalized. You can manipulate the data several ways. Even the decrease in the American English publications. You do have things developing in the 70s and 80s, these new paradigm churches, Calvary Chapel, Vineyard, all the Jesus people coming to faith. There's the Anaheim Vineyard. We'll look more closely at them later. There's another picture of the Anaheim Vineyard. Here's the impact of the latter rain. I'm moving very quickly through this because I want to, we'll get to this all in more detail later. Okay. You start getting non-Pentecostal awareness of the praise and worship incubation, if I might call it that. Here are the specific numbers from the Complete Library of Christian Worship in terms of the use of the different terms. So you can even see in the Complete Library, praise and worship is the more dominant term than contemporary worship is. And then, this is probably the pinnacle of mainline recognition of that praise and worship strand. This is a 1991 theme issue from the Christian Reformed Church on praise and worship. Bob Weber has an article in there. And the rest of it tends to be from Christian Reformed folks who've been adopting the Pentecostal strand. Notice the hand posture. But notice the woman's dress.
Yeah.
So informality in this strand is not yet kicked in. This is the engram on praise and worship. And so you can notice, again, similar sort of peak through the mid-80s, falling off. And then starting in the late 80s, going through the 90s, increasing use of that phrase. I need to continue to do some analysis of this data to see whether or not it's being used as a technical phrase or as a non-technical sort of word. Praise and worship had circulated in evangelical and Pentecostal circles previously up through the 70s, but it wasn't a technical term. Because sometimes I see the reverse of it. I'll find a source that says, and then we have worship and praise. And they just, praise and worship was just a way of saying we had a service. Late 70s, it becomes a technical way of saying we had a service that began with praise and then we moved to worship. I think in terms of the last rise of the term contemporary worship, this other factor in the incubation of the 70s and 80s is important, the rise of contemporary Christian music. And so that helped reinforce in Christian consciousness that contemporary term. And since contemporary worship tended to use new forms of music, it was easy. The presence of the term contemporary in this phrase, contemporary Christian music, would help reinforce it in the phrase contemporary worship too. That was just a convoluted way of saying these things are mutually reinforcing. Yeah. Another incubation, this is the little bit more data on the church growth thing. Church growth thinking actually began as a missiological reflection on why some churches grew or some missions grew and others didn't around the world. And then starting at Fuller School of Theology, they developed a School of Missions World Evangelism there. Donald McGavran, who's the keynote thinker in the whole movement, comes to Fuller, trains other people, and they begin doing that sort of analysis to American churches. So why do some American churches grow and other American churches don't? This reinforces the tradition questioning tendencies of the 1960s, because by and large what they find is, well, if you do things an old way, that tends not to produce good numbers. It reinforces the generational thinking. So you get subtle marketing. Not so subtle. You get marketing sensibilities hitting church consciousness, and it reinforces the sense of propriety and necessity. Here's a book from that period. I actually have owned this. I have first edition that I bought when I was a pastor in the late 1980s. 44 Ways to Increase Church Attendance. Anybody else own this book? And it's really not about church attendance generally. It's 44 Ways to Increase Worship Attendance. Very, very pragmatic. The example I always use from it as you go in and you take a look at your attendance patterns for communion Sundays. And so if your attendance goes up on communion Sundays, you have communion more often. If your attendance goes down on communion Sundays, you have communion less often. When I was a pastor in the late 80s, we didn't use the term contemporary worship. When we were talking about experimentation, innovation in Methodist circles, this is what we were talking about, with a very, very strong generational thing to it. The backdrop to this, especially among mainliners, is the sense of numeric decline, demise in the church. We're just going to dry up one day, completely wither away and blow away. We must find some way to reverse this decline in numbers. Has anyone ever lived in that ecclesial world? Okay. That's what's happening starting in the 60s, but especially more needs to be done. But I think that consciousness really locks on in the 80s and the 90s. One of the things that I and my research assistant have done, we've gone through all of the back issues from the 1970s of Circuit Rider magazine, which is the magazine sent to every United Methodist pastor. And it's quite clear from the 80s forward, there's a recurrent anxiety. Our numbers are decreasing, our numbers are decreasing, our numbers are decreasing. What can we do? What can we do? What can we do? And it's interesting, whatever the theme issue is, that's always the solution, you know. That will change in the mid-90s, when they finally have a theme issue on contemporary worship. And they'll go, oh, that's been the problem. Our worship hasn't been in the right style. The groundswell of the 1990s, so this is when we're going to see this latest eruption of the term. And you can see the factors that I think are involved there. And like the emergence of anything, oftentimes the beginning point, and even the development's not always necessarily clear. This is a wonderful quote from being right on the verge, and you can see what the binary terms are here. It's not contemporary and traditional, it's alternative and traditional. This is a Lutheran author, conservative Lutheran author, Paul Westermeyer. And you can see alternative worship is apparently the Protestant answer to evangelism in the 1990s, as you can see. This is the unleashing of the term. So 1990s forward. Here's this first book using the term in the title. It is even in the subtitle, How to Create Contemporary Worship. And notice it's a how-to title. By and large, in the Pentecostal literature, I don't find the how-to-ness as overt. And I think that's because the fundamental presumption is this is a gift from God.
That's exciting.
And that, there's a pragmatism there, and we'll talk to Jim about this later. You know, what are people actually learning at the International Worship Symposium? Because they're teaching how to do this, because this has gotten a standardized form. But the mainline literature tends to start right there, and it's almost formulaic. And the image that I use, I'll show you the next picture. The image that I use, another analogy, is computer system operating, operator interface, and the interface and operating system. That's what I was trying to get to. The Pentecostal strands have merged those, or those are well integrated. So the operating system being kind of like the underlying spirituality and theology, and then the interface is the technique of how to do it. The Protestant how-to books tend to be almost just interface without operating system. So the biblical spirituality, the biblical interpretation, the sense that this is a gift from God tends not to be expressed. The most interesting example of that divorce that I found, I was interviewing Mary Cyphers. Anybody recognize her name? I mean, she's written a lot of the United Methodist kind of supplemental worship resources. She was an early adopter, United Methodist, up in the Pacific Northwest, Washington State, I think it was. So she started implementing contemporary worship services mid to late 90s. And she, I asked her how she did it. She said, well, I do this and I do this. But when it came time to hire the musician, I would never hire a Methodist musician. Why wouldn't you hire? She said, they didn't get it. You know, further reflection of what she was saying, they did not understand the operating system. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This piety that you had to linger in the music, you use the music to enter into the presence of God. They just, the Methodist musicians she, you know, had access to just saw it as, okay, so you want me to play this song rather than this song, use this instrument rather than this instrument.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Can you do your illustration again between the operating system and interface? You say charismatics, but which way and the Protestant?
Charismatics, all Pentecostals always had a merger of the operating system and the interface. The mainlines, and I think this would apply to some mainline evangelicals too, like Baptists, tended to see this essentially as adoption of a style. The interface without adoption of the operating system. I mean, when I talk about the Anaheim Vineyard example in just a little bit, their original worship leader, Carl Tuttle, was helped because he was coming from a Quaker background. So I asked Carl, I said, tell me about your rehearsal practices. He said, what rehearsal practices? I said, tell me how you constructed a worship set. Okay, this was easy. He said, I got there with my guitar and I prayed. And whatever first song the Spirit told me to do, that's where we started. Hmm. And then, and here's the key, he's actively discerning the Spirit's movement through the entire set. That's what Mary Cyphers couldn't find in the Methodist musicians. And the ability to assess what was happening and to make those spur-of-the-moment, subtle musical shifts to accentuate or extend what was happening. I mean, y'all know what I'm talking about, right?
Yes.
You know, and that's probably spread over to mainline musicians today just because the phenomenon is so widespread. But when she was early adopting in the mid to late 1990s, she had to go to Pentecostal circles to find the musicians that she wanted.
By the way, you don't bring Calvary Chapel into that charismatic Pentecostal unless you see them more.
Calvary Chapel is an interesting story.
Because when I grew up, most of my friends were Calvary Chapel, but they were, I guess from my Southern Baptist upbringing, they were much more charismatic than I was in their experience and in their practice and worship.
I mean, Chuck Smith Sr., who's the pastor of Calvary Chapel, he's lifelong Pentecostal. He's four square gospel
right. In
background. But he had grown dissatisfied with what he saw as some of the manipulatory character of some of the overt Pentecostalism. And so he's always very suspicious of that. And so centers his ministry and the liturgical life of Calvary Chapel on expository verse-by-verse preaching of the Bible. And much of all this wonderful new music being generated by all these Jesus people in his church, that music, on the whole, is not used on Sunday morning. It's used in the midweek meetings. When the rains are held a little bit less tight.
The Catholic chapels still do that. You'll see Wednesday nights, they're not still in the service. I don't think they even know they're doing that anymore.
No.
They do it now. So.
And I think over the long haul, Calvary, that strand, Calvary Chapels have more contemporized their Sunday morning. But even the one time I heard Chuck Smith Sr. preach, probably 2012 or so, Sunday morning, he came out, coat, tie. You know, I was expecting big band, rock concert. You know, this was a mother church of contemporary worship. And it was a very restrained kind of mainstream evangelical service, you know, with a eclectic mix of music on Sunday morning. And he really disliked what he saw as potential downsides of Pentecostal manipulation, overstructuring. Here's the First Circuit Rider magazine, United Methodist publication, theme issue on contemporary worship. Okay. Here's a Lutheran resource from the same period. And essentially, in these early books, they have to define what contemporary worship is. Okay? I've gone through the newsletters and the periodicals for the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. You can see growing use of it. Here's the first United Methodist How-To Guide from 1995. If we have a little bit of time, this comes with, it came with a video cassette. I have it digitized. We will take a look at this a little bit. It's quite interesting. Here are Lutherans trying to block it. Floodgates open. Here's the impact of Abington Press, and by and large, they're the most prolific author in using, publisher using the term. I love this. This is the advertisement from Lester Memorial. This is the early adopter of contemporary worship in Northern Alabama, United Methodism. And I'll tell this story and then we'll break for lunch. This pastor is a perfect example. So he played guitar, acoustic guitar. He was used to playing acoustic guitar working with youth. He's a reserve chaplain in the Army. Desert Storm, that war breaks out in 91. He goes to Iraq, takes his guitar with him, and discovers that he can lead adults in worship with a guitar. And a guitar is a pretty easy thing for him to carry around in Iraq. Comes back, gets sent to Oneonta, Alabama, where the Methodist campground is. And they have folks there walk to Emmaus, which is an internal United Methodist renewal movement. Lots of walk to Emmaus folks in this church, and they've been clamoring for worship that's more like their walk to Emmaus experience. And he says, describe it to me. They describe it to him. He says, well, that sounds kind of like what I've been doing on the guitar over in Iraq. So they start a second service, a contemporary service. It takes off. And I find this in quite a few early adopters. Sometimes the lead musician, the worship leader, is the pastor. And I think that actually helps the acceptability of it. Begin at the Fellowship Hall. This is their advertisement. And the characteristics and formality, updated English, relevance, new music, it's all there, an option. Long story short, they put these advertisements out in the few restaurants that are in this small town in Alabama. The bishop, United Methodist bishop, and the district superintendents are in retreat at the campground there, come into town, eat at the restaurant, see the advertisement. The next thing this guy knows, he's the district superintendent of Birmingham, Alabama. Sent there by the bishop in order to implement these services in as many churches as he can. Wow. Not a name that you would recognize, and in fact his name's escaping me right now. I'm kind of embarrassed. You're not interviewed him twice. But these are the stories that really interest me because they actually show you what's going on, the long history, the adoption of it, and the uniqueness of it at the time. So anyway, let's go eat.